Welcome to Vanity Fair. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer Gretchen Steele, reading today from the April 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. We'll first wrap up the feature, The Confessions of Inigo Philbrick, by Mark Seal. Episode 5, The Escape. Are you okay? Baker Harbor asked Philbrick in the midst of a torrential thunderstorm in Miami, where they were temporarily residing. It was October 20th, 2019. Lightning crackled across the tropical skies as the couple waited for an Uber in a covered parking lot. They had just watched Joaquin Phoenix demonize Gotham City in Joker, and Philbrick seemed in a fragile state, says Baker Harbor. Philbrick, by then, knew of at least one lawsuit against him, and his lawyer had advised him that I no longer had a seat at the table and that this was a matter for the lawyers. If I had to go somewhere for a while, would you come with me? He asked her. The next morning she woke to a suitcase slamming to the floor in their sunny condominium. Where are we going? She asked. I don't know, said Philbrick. She suggested visiting her grandmother in Australia. Within hours, they were on a Qantas flight, cattle class, says Baker Harbor. During a layover at the Dallas-Fort Worth airport, Philbrick withdrew his last $400 at an ATM. Landing in Sydney, they were told that brush fires ruled out a flight to her grandmother's rural home in New South Wales. They tried her late grandfather's birthplace in Fiji, but couldn't get a flight that day. McGow says, we have no information that Victoria was aware of the fraud scheme. Why don't we go to Vanuatu? She asked Philbrick. My mother has friends there. After more than a month of travel with stops in Japan, Australia, and New Caledonia, they made a temporary home in Vanuatu, a small archipelago nation in the southwestern Pacific whose borders quickly shut down due to COVID, says Baker Harbor. Many would later point out that Vanuatu has no extradition treaty with the U.S. It became a respite for Philbrick, from the art world, from attorneys, and from a cesspool of debt. For months, the couple reveled in the village-like environment, Baker Harbor says, enjoying the fresh fruit, the pho in the workers' cafes, the sun-kissed beaches. Philbrick even got a government-issued Vanuatu driver's license using his full name. 6 months after their arrival, Baker Harbor was pregnant. I was traveling on my U.S. passport, hardly a fugitive, insists Philbrick. The Justice Department, which considered him one in April 2020, disagrees. Back home, burned collectors were seething. Attorney Judd Grossman, who represents several of Philbrick's former clients, offers a representative opinion when he calls Philbrick greedy. He did this to benefit himself, to live the lifestyle that he saw so many of his clients living, but when things didn't go his way, rather than face the music, he ran, and he left all of them holding the bag. In a December 2019 ArtNet column, Philbrick's former friend, client, and hard burgundy-drinking buddy Kenny Schachter called Philbrick's disappearance the art world's equivalent of Where's Waldo. Schachter designed a wanted poster of Philbrick, $10,000 reward, and published excerpts of Instagram messages he received from someone calling themselves at Steve_Irwin_pets, the Aussie naturalist, speared to death by one of the stingrays he cared so deeply about. Get it? Schachter's influence was clear. The sender was Philbrick, on the lam from the collectors he felt he had so capably served. Nobody was stiffed. It was just a few bad deals, wrote at Steve_Irwin_pets. Things will be made good. Philbrick says he never sent these messages. The story went viral, at least in the art world. Determined to tell their story their way, Philbrick and Baker Harbor helped produce a TV docuseries treatment, which ramped up the drama of the disappearance. It's one of the most jaw-dropping art world stories of recent years, the producers would later say, culminating in a love story that spanned multiple countries, multi-million-dollar art deals, and an international manhunt ending in an exotic South Pacific archipelago. On the afternoon of June 12, 2020, the long arm of the law reached from across the ocean. It was 3 p.m. and Philbrick and Baker Harbor were in the local market searching for what they'd heard was an amazing green tea tarot cake. Walking through a series of what he calls tin-roofed breeze block shops, they reached their destination, where the taro cake awaited. But then, an eerie silence, parting the crowd of peaceful islanders was a team, Philbrick recalls, of burly giants in flak jackets. Baker Harbor, 5.5 months pregnant, watched her fiancé's face turn white, like he'd been tasered. Then one of the giants spoke, "Are you Inigo Philbrick?" "And it's almost like watching an animal being electrocuted," she says. "They hustled Philbrick into a red Ford, handcuffs biting my wrists, 5 of us in the car, squeezed between 2 sweaty giants in the back, their Kevlar panels blowing out of their vests and digging into my sides." Where are they taking him, Baker Harbor thought, trailing behind in a car between 2 municipal police officers who had taken their phones. The car carrying Philbrick sped past the local prison and then the courthouse, and there was only one place left, Port Vila International Airport. They parked on the tarmac, and there, on what Philbrick calls an island that looked like it could be on the set of Jurassic Park, waited a Gulfstream V. "And I'm thinking, there's something wrong with his visa," recalls Baker Harbor. "But she was unable to get answers, because these men were holding me down." "Get the fuck off me," she shouted once the plane was airborne, leaping out of the car and clawing at the fence, screaming, "Where are you taking him?" She collapsed onto the sidewalk, where the officers returned her phones, then drove her home. "I memorized the tail number," she says. Soon she tracked down the plane's flight plan, Guam, and its registered owner, a Russian chess player, she says, and remembers thinking, "He's been abducted by Russians. What the fuck has he done?" She found a phone number, and what the chess player told her was both a relief and a terror. "I lease my plane to the U.S. government." "Wanted, U.S. national deported," read the headline in the Vanuatu Daily Post over a photograph of Philbrick in beachwear between 2 officers escorting him toward the giant jet. He'd been charged with wire fraud and aggravated identity theft. They made the independent decision to expel Mr. Philbrick from the island. He was not extradited, McGow says of the Vanuatu officials. Philbrick landed in Guam, home of the nearest FBI office, in a bathing suit and polo shirt. "I was wearing castanier espadrilles and shoved into a cell with Billy, a guy doing intermittent detention," Philbrick says of his tumultuous entry into the U.S. prison system, where he spent the next 3.5 years. In November 2021, having not seen daylight for almost 2 years, according to his fiancée, Philbrick entered a federal courthouse in Manhattan. His best-dressed list suits now traded for dingy brown prison garb, his fabulous crown of curly locks grown long and unkempt, his facial hair overgrown, his stylish silhouette shrunken from a prison diet of peanut butter sandwiches and lunch meat. "Mr. Philbrick, let me ask you this," asked Judge Sidney H. Stein. "Why did you do this?" "For money, Your Honor," Philbrick replied, his ever-so-proper accent muffled by his N95 COVID mask, adding, "I was trying to find business and needed money for that." "How do you plead, sir?" "Guilty, Your Honor." If only the Made in Chelsea cameras had been around to catch these extraordinary events, reported the Daily Mail of the drama of Philbrick's arrest and court appearance. Instead, by the time the E4 reality TV show returned for its 23rd series last month, Victoria had slipped effortlessly back into her glamorous London life with a daughter, Gaia Grace, in tow. "Where's Gaia's dad?" a fellow cast member asked Baker Harbor, who is clad in glam red furry vest on the show. "He's incarcerated right now, like awaiting sentencing," she responds. "It's financial, white-collar stuff, but unfortunately he is being held in a place which is like maximum security. I've only seen him once since all of this has happened, and he was shackled." "He looked good in his prison uniform," Baker Harbor adds, "although orange is not really his color." Episode 6, The Comeback. "You're like the talented Mr. Ripley," Schachter, who claims to have lost $1.75 million to his former friend, reportedly texted Philbrick when he was at large. He wrote back, "Google how the movie ended." "So Mr. Schachter did," wrote the New York Times reporter Jacob Bernstein. "It turns out Ripley strangles the person who may be about to expose him. Philbrick says he was not in contact with Schachter." Philbrick, however, seems poised for a rebirth. Both on the screen, first the multi-part Blue Ant Productions documentary with the working title The Real Inigo Philbrick Story, A Tale of Fortune, Fame, and Fraud, expected to air on the BBC in the summer, and in real life. "I'm 36, still a young man, And a second act is going to require my having been upfront and sincere, but also not a martyr, he says. My name is soiled, but I own it again, he continues, claiming that when various documents come to light, it might change the perception of his culpability. Of course, I did things the wrong way, says Philbrick, but creatively and with the best of intentions. I'll have to tick the box for the felony, but I believe the art world is sophisticated enough to understand that I wasn't Bernie Madoff, who never made an actual investment. That may be decidedly wishful thinking. One client called his losses to Philbrick the worst nightmare of my life. Philbrick was charming and a good communicator, while in reality he was only a sleek liar trying to get closer to his victims. Philbrick was released from prison into home confinement and 2 years of supervised release in late January after being incarcerated for less than 4 years. He has a new wardrobe accessory, an electronic monitoring ankle bracelet, along with a sizable debt, $86,672,790 in restitution, on which Philbrick says he'll begin making monthly payments following his release, which means he'll have to get back to work, and in the unregulated art world, there's no legal mechanism stopping him. Although his first priority is Baker Harbor and their 3-year-old daughter, Gaia, he foresees a professional future. I'd like to get reestablished as an art dealer, he says. And that's going to require a lot of listening and discussing with friends, clients, colleagues. I've had some indications of interest from friends in helping me get started, but it's too early to say more. And this concludes the Confessions of Inigo Philbrick, the April 2024 feature by Mark Seal. We'll next turn to The Dean's List by Nate Freeman, appearing in the same issue. The music industry power couple Alicia Keys and Kasim Swizzbeats Dean have helped lead the way for a generation of collectors of black art. The rest of the world is finally catching up. In early 2015, the musician Kasim Dean, known as Swizzbeats, went with artist Kehinde Wiley to see his retrospective A New Republic at the Brooklyn Museum. Dean had been churning out hits as a hip-hop producer for more than 2 decades, propelling singles by the likes of Jay-Z, DMX, Busta Rhymes, and Beyoncé to global inescapability. But Dean, along with his Grammy-winning superstar wife Alicia Keys, is also a contemporary art patron who caught the bug well before his peers in the hip-hop game. A lot of people used to make fun of me collecting art. I won't say no names, but they're the biggest names, Dean told me recently. We were so hardcore in music, I was a rough rider. Everybody was more in their street element, and so collecting art, he trailed off. Walking through the Wiley Show in 2015, Dean was already itching to move to the next echelon. The loaned works came from institutions all over the country, but also a number of private collectors, a hedge fund executive, a manager at a different hedge fund, the manager of a tech billionaire's family office. Dean realized, reading the wall labels, that he saw no last names of color. Wiley and Dean walked in front of Femme Piquée par un Serpent, a 25-foot-long painting of a black man in a bed based on a sculpture in the Musée d'Orsay. Courtesy Sean Kelly, New York, its label read, referring to Wiley's commercial gallery. Such wording is often a super insider way to say, this might just be for sale. Wiley was hesitant at first. While Dean and Keys were globally famous musicians, they had not put in enough time dancing the art world tango of museum donations, gallery dinner schmoozing, gala hobnobbing, and eyebrow-raising purchases that moves burgeoning collectors up the waiting lists. I told him, is this work better off going back into storage or being where we can display your work for the audience that you're saying is lacking? Dean recalled. He paused and looked at his wife, and Kehinde was like, do you know what? I'm going to do it. 9 years later, Femme Piquée par un Serpent is back at the Brooklyn Museum as part of Giants, art from the Dean collection of Swizzbeats and Alicia Keys, a show of nearly 100 artworks, about a third of the couple's total holdings, that's up until July. On a weekday in early February, as the Deans were preparing for its opening gala, I spoke with the couple about their collection's first major museum exhibition and the effort that brought it to being. We've done every single piece of the process, all of the layouts and the whole thing, Keys says. But the thing that blows our mind the most is that, just like everybody else who's going to walk through these doors, We have never seen this collection hung, ever. As visitors walk into the museum's center pavilion, there's Arthur Jaffa's Big Wheel 1, a 7,000-pound sculpture of a tire that rises 17 feet in the air. On one wall is Amy Sherald's Deliverance, a giant diptych that wowed at Hauser & Wirth during Freeze London in 2022. There's an enormous three-part painting by Gagauzian-repped multi-hyphenate Titus Kaphar that the couple acquired directly from the artist's studio and has never been publicly unveiled. The largest ever work by Melico Mokosi, a 21-panel epic, takes up an entire room of the show. There's also a selection of photographs by Gordon Parks and pieces by a grab bag of some of the most exciting artists currently alive: Henry Taylor, Deanna Lawson, Toyin Oji Odutola, Mikkelin Thomas, Jordan Castile, Odili Donald Odita, Derek Adams, and so on. And the first works that greet you as you enter are Portraits of the Collectors by Wiley. I mentioned to Keys that I'd never seen them before. "We've never seen them either," she said. "They're still drying." "They're still wet," Dean added. "We're not joking." The Deans have built strong relationships with the artists they collect, allowing them to access to primo works that would have otherwise been held for the world's greatest collections. Nicola Vassell, who was the curatorial director of the collection for years and now has her own gallery in Chelsea, attributed their ability to build a world-class collection to the trust and love that the artists have for them. "Say you have a group of three, four amazing collectors who could get a work," Vassell says. "Sometimes what shifts the balance is the artist, who they hope they can own the work, and the context in which the work will live." The Deans also were collecting black artists, especially black figurative artists, at a time when the art market had started to correct for decades of neglect. Dean was particularly struck by the contrast he saw between visits to the homes of old guard collectors and his peers. It further fueled their collecting. The couple put many of their largest-scale works on view at their homes, including a $20 million mansion in La Jolla, California, that is said to have inspired Tony Stark's house in Iron Man 3, and have never sold a work since the inception of their collection. "You have a Bearden, you have a Basquiat, you have this, you have that. You had Ernie Barnes, you had Gordon Parks," Dean told me. "Then I go to my friend's house. They didn't have none of those things." In 2019, Dean and Keys made the Art News Top 200 Collectors list, the definitive ranking of global art buyers. With it came access to primary market works, usually reserved for not for the top 200 collectors, but the top 20. Sources indicated that the waiting list for one of the only four large-scale Sherald works at her first show with Hauser & Wirth was enormous, but the gigantic diptych went to the Dean collection. Brooklyn Museum Director Anne Pasternak has also had a front-row seat to the Dean's rise. Shortly after taking the job, she was at the Brooklyn Heights townhouse owned by Board Vice Chair Stephanie Ingracia, where she was introduced to Dean. After just a few minutes of talking, she and Ingracia asked him to join the board. "I will tell you that there were artists and others who were really skeptical, who would dismiss them from the get-go just as celebrities. Like, what do they have to offer?" Pasternak said. "They have absolutely proven themselves to be true and blue and absolutely committed to the artists in a way that the artists see now, and they all want to be in this collection." In the years since, the couple opened an artist residency in Arizona called Dreamland and an art and music festival called No Commission that pops up at art fairs like Art Basel Miami Beach. In 2019, they staged a selling group show at UTA Artist Space in L.A. called Dreamweavers, that consisted partly of work co-signed directly by artists and Gordon Parks' Selections from the Dean Collection, opened at the Ethelbert Cooper Gallery at Harvard. During the COVID-19 lockdown, Pasternak started thinking about putting together a show. "They call it the Dean Collection. They imagine it to have its own wing in the museum at some point in the future," she told me. "My mind really started to think seriously about doing an exhibition, in part because he and Alicia have used their platforms as artists to celebrate and fight for the rights of other artists with real passion." When the show was announced, there were some grumblings about a major New York institution giving a private collection such cherished real estate. Pasternak dismissed the notion, citing the fact that 30 Americans, a show of work from the collection of Don and Mara Rubel, toured the museums for years to great acclaim. In 2019, the Smart Museum at the University of Chicago staged an exhibition of work owned by Pamela J. Joyner and Alfred J. Giuffrida. "Look at the Laudet collection at the Met, right?" she said. Both Keyes and Dean were born in New York and became young phenoms at nearly the same time. In Hell's Kitchen, Keyes' mother would play the records of Billie Holiday and other jazz greats, which led Keyes to a classical music education on the piano, and at 21, more Grammy statuettes than she could get hold at once. Keyes racked up several more platinum records in the years since. For the rest of time, you will not attend a Big Apple sporting event without her voice reminding you that New York is a concrete jungle where dreams are made of. Dean grew up in the Bronx, with a father who was close with DJ Kool Herc at the birth of hip-hop, and two uncles who started influential crew, Rough Riders. After starting to DJ at age 12, Dean began messing around with beats at an Atlanta studio in 1998 and showed DMX the beat that would become Rough Riders' anthem, a harbinger of the kitchen sink percussion meets earwormy sonic idiom he has since developed. The hits brought houses, and suddenly something needed to go on the walls. Dean grew up selling street art in the South Bronx, where Keith Haring would put up tags. Keyes, too, recalls having a poster of Gustav Klimt's The Kiss on the wall growing up, and later discovering Ernie Barnes through the sleeve of a Marvin Gaye record. "For those who don't know that, collecting art is a drug," Dean said. "It's a serious drug, and once you get hooked onto the drug, just like any drug, it's hard to get off." By the time Dean and Keyes married in 2010, they were completely devoted to collecting living artists in depth, visiting their studios, consulting them on the installation of the work, and hanging out as much as possible. Vassell, who has worked at the Deitch Projects and Pace, pointed the couple toward emerging artists who would soon become young stars, including Nathaniel Mary Quinn, Ebony G. Patterson, and Shabalala Self. Those relationships were on full display at the Brooklyn Museum opening night, where the artists had gathered prior to the arrival of the Board of Trustees and other VIPs. Wiley's white-on-white Celine Trainer zipped from one end of the room to the other as Dean came out to greet him with a bow, and Keyes emerged from behind a backdrop to yell hola at Nick Cave. Castile came in with OG Odutola, and as I was chatting with Kafar, he looked ahead and announced, "Oh, the legend just walked in." There was Micheline Thomas. Jaffa came in with Hank Willis Thomas, who was just with Kennedy Yonko and Sherald. Adams approached Nina Chanel Abney with a bit of a stutter step and embraced a number of the artists. Eventually, Jamel Shabazz showed up to snap pictures of everyone. "This is like my Met Gala," said a Brooklyn Museum employee. After a few minutes, Keyes clapped and told the artists, "Everyone, please join us downstairs on the first floor for a toast at 6 on the dot, 5:55, actually. The crowd filtered downstairs. Most openings attract a few hundred museum members and guests. Attendance of the invite-only bash would top 1,200, including the artist Cause, Ford Foundation President Darren Walker, and Art Basel CEO Noah Horowitz. Waiters passed around flutes of Hennessy Paradis for a toast, and Pasternak joined Dean and Keyes on a riser to address the room. She suggested that, before the VIP crowds got to the museum, the artists in the show should join their collectors to see it. Only Dean and Keyes and the artists. No curators, no board members, no directors of the museum. "Is that fair?" she asked. It was deemed fair. Dean walked toward the door to the exhibition with Keyes strolling into the show with OG Otadola and Castile, the three of them arm in arm. And this concludes the Dean's List by Nate Freeman. Finally, we'll hear Turner Classic by Kara Warner. In the last few years, English actor Callum Turner has worked with Clooney, Hanks, and Spielberg. So yes, you could say it's going well. VF catches up with Hollywood's latest heartthrob as he takes downtown NYC in style. Being anointed the next big thing is a famously loaded experience, since it could be the springboard to either glory or despair. It's on that precipice that we meet Callum Turner. He's in the midst of an international press tour and chatting over Zoom from a luxury hotel suite, unsure of how many interviews he's completed or, he jokes, even what day it is. There's an unexpected bit of drama, though, when one of the potato chips he's casually munching on gets lodged in his throat. "Sorry, that crisp just dried out my mouth," he says, reaching fast for a bottle of water. "I don't want to die eating a Pringle. What a way to go." The former Burberry model is fresh off his starring role in George Clooney's holiday sleeper hit, The Boys in the Boat, and is now promoting his acclaimed performance in Masters of the Air, the Apple TV Plus series executive produced by Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg, and Gary Getzman. There's also a rumored romance with pop star Dua Lipa, which Turner sidesteps addressing, though when pressed, he admits that his favorite Dua Lipa song is Houdini. Turner is clearly enjoying the ride thus far. "It just keeps getting better," he says. Turner's first high-profile role was in the Fantastic Beasts franchise as Eddie Redmayne's dashing brother, but he proved to have a knack for roguish types as well. In 2020's Emma with Anya Taylor-Joy, he played the distinctly unsuitable suitor Frank Churchill. In Masters, he plays real-life World War II pilot Major John Bucky Egan with swashbuckling panache. Egan had a real mischievousness about him, and so does Callum, says Getzman. The role required Turner to ditch his British accent for a Midwestern one, which he liked to maintain offset. "The game was to make people think that I was American," he says. Turner is a playful interview subject, doling out genuine sentiment and cheek in equal measure. "My favorite was drinking a lot of whiskey," he says, eyes twinkling. "That helped a lot to get into the character, because that's what Egan was doing. He was dealing with the traumas." Turner was raised by a single mom in one of the only working-class areas of London's posh Chelsea neighborhood. He worked in retail at the age of 15. "My mom got me a job in my rival soccer team's club shop, so I had to wear the tracksuit of Fulham, and I am a Chelsea fan." After a brief stint playing semi-pro soccer, he left home to work as a model in Japan, Italy, and France. At 19, he turned to acting. "I told enough people I wanted to do it. That gave me a fear of not doing it," he says. Turner started taking night classes and later hired an acting coach he's been working with for 11 years now. "He's a movie star," says Getzman. "He's formidable in every way you want an actor, and he's a great guy to have around. Tom Hanks and I never hire for star power. We hire for the part. But over time, you get a sense of who they are and what their range might be in their life of acting, and he's got no boundaries on him." The privilege of working with legends is not lost on Turner, who isn't shy about asking for advice or observing people's methods. "They feel a great sense of responsibility, not just for their jobs individually, but for the industry as a whole," he says. "They welcome you into the community, and it's a real pleasure being part of it." Turner was recently cast in A Prayer for the Dying. If superstardom is in his future, he plans on following the Clooney method for staying grounded. George's friends are still his friends from when he was like 18 years old, and even though he's famous, he's the same guy. "If I met George Clooney in 1990, he'd be the same bloke as the man I worked with 30 years later. I'm going to stay the same. Same as George and Tom and Gary. I'm so lucky that I have a wonderful group of friends and family. Even if I thought about getting too cocky, they'd let me know. Just don't ask Turner to row crew again. What we did was so special. Those guys are mates for life," he says of his Boys in the Boats co-stars. "Also, if I went and rowed on the Thames now, George Clooney wouldn't be screaming at me with a megaphone to do it better, so it wouldn't be as fun." And this wraps up Turner Classic by Kara Warner in the April 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. And it concludes our time for Vanity Fair today. Once again, I'm Virginia Voice volunteer Gretchen Steele, and you can listen to this program on demand anytime at www.virginiavoice.org.